Hello and welcome to the Peter A. Allard School of Law History Project. I'm the History Project Student Coordinator, Alexander Starr, and today I'm interviewing Mr. Scott Lamb of the class of 1989. Welcome.
Thank you, Alex, for having me.
Can you tell us a bit about yourself?
Just by way of background, I was born in Edmonton, Alberta, and raised there to the age of 11. It was a wonderful childhood, filled with playing lots of hockey outdoors and playing in the ravines of the North Saskatchewan River, and it was a pretty carefree experience. And then my family moved to Vancouver, and I attended St. George's School here in Vancouver. And then I think what's brought me to your attention, I attended UBC Law School.
Yes, yes, correct. What interested you in studying law school?
I think it provided, first of all, the potential to practice law, but it also attracted me because of the great training that it gave you. And when I was first interested in going to law school, I wasn't sure if I wanted to practice, and I had a lot of interest from my undergraduate, which is international relations, and even contemplated the idea of doing a master's in that and carrying on to do the diplomatic corps or something like that in government. And then I settled on the idea that law school would be certainly no less a good qualification than a master's.
You and I share that. I haven't told you that, but I have an undergraduate from UBC in international relations as well. Did you enjoy your undergraduate at UBC as well?
Yes, I did. I enjoyed it very much.
Yeah.
UBC was a great environment in the early 80s, and the university was getting better and better, and its reputation was increasing. So the quality of the education was getting better and better. But the atmosphere out there was a lot of fun as well. And an undergraduate degree should be fun as well as giving you that good grounding for things later in life.
Don't just have a law degree from UBC, though. You have a law degree as well from the University of Bristol.
Yes.
Yes.
And
how did that come about?
Well, in part because I was thinking that I might want to go and go back into the diplomatic corps or something like that, or I wanted to do a master's. And someone pointed out to me that I could go away to university outside of Canada and still get a law degree. And I thought that was a great, great idea. And it really intrigued me, and so I decided I would go on a great adventure. And it was a great challenge. It was a top-ranked law school, and but it was much more than just getting a good law degree. I often say it was like getting a sociology degree, because in the mid-'80s in Britain, there was a lot of changes going on politically.
Yeah.
And I found that to be fascinating. And so I learned a lot about Britain as a country. But through that, because of our shared history, learned a lot about my own country. And it became interesting to get that perspective, even in my legal studies. So they had a course there called public law, which is their equivalent of constitutional law. And of course, without a written constitution that we're familiar with in North America, and no charter of rights, it was interesting to go through that course and get the perspective of British professors and my fellow students. A great example was I was in a tutorial with a bunch of the students, and the question was, do you believe that a charter of rights is a good protector of your freedoms? And the interesting part is that most of the British students, the four or five others that were in my group, they thought that it wasn't very much of a protection. They quickly used examples of, well, the French have had five constitutions, and the Soviets have a really great one. If you read it, it looks wonderful. It protects everything. They really were extremely cynical about anything that was written on a piece of paper as you guarantee your freedom. They were much more pragmatic and practical about saying that their best guarantor of their freedom was at the ballot box. And those parliamentary conventions and system was their best guarantee of their freedom and the best guarantor of a progressive society.
I mean, for you, and the contrast, having, I guess, a charter from your home country to compare, but still a fairly new one at that time, was there much to say, or was the charter still too recent from a Canadian perspective?
I really didn't really learn about the charter and a lot of its significance until I came back to UBC Law School, and that was interesting, because you're right, it was still, by the late 80s, was still evolving. But, of course, there was the example of south of the border for us, and how that was unfolded for 200 years. So a lot of what we were expecting wasn't surprising. So there was a lot to chew on already to debate about. But it was an interesting contrast. It was just one example.
Yeah.
It was very much an interesting contrast of perspectives, which... well, legal, they're also culturally rooted.
Yeah. There's probably a couple other differences, but can you recall any kind of the differences between Bristol and UBC as far as legal education?
Very different. In Britain, the universities typically have the tutorial system. And so there are lectures,
yeah,
but your tutorials are very important. So you meet as a large group. In my law class, probably about 150 people, smaller than UBC.
Mm-hmm.
The law faculties tend to be much smaller. And then we'd be divided up into tutorial groups of between 4 and 6 people, where you'd meet with your lecturer or professor and in a small group. And they would assign you little tasks or reading lists and questions, and you come back and then you discuss them in a small group. I thought that was, frankly, a great system for education generally, not just for legal education. So that was very valuable. But and the other thing was that it was interesting. The marking system was different, and there wasn't so much emphasis on what someone got as a percentage. They didn't even give you percentages. They gave you a classification of a degree. So you could get a first-class degree, a second-class upper,
yeah,
degree, a second-class lower, a third-class a pass and a fail. And the interesting thing is that most people are generally bunched in the middle.
Yeah.
And very few people were at the top, and very few people failed. Although in my year, I think one person failed, and then one person got a first class. Everyone was sort of bunched in the center, and they had a lot of cynicism about what truly the difference could be between someone that got 72 and 75% on something.
Yeah.
Yet that might make the difference if whether they got a one kind of degree. So I kind of sided with that. Most of the people there were pretty bright, and
yeah,
everyone was getting on with it. But they weren't afraid of actually failing some people, and they were very reluctant to give people a very good mark, and like a first class mark.
Yeah.
If you got that first class, you were clearly head and shoulders above everybody else in the class. They also, the exams were a little bit more rigorous in the sense that they were 100% exams like at UBC, but they were longer and they were closed book. So you had to remember everything before you went. They seem to like that idea. I don't know how practically that makes much of a difference, but that was the way they did things.
Wow. You mentioned that you had some brilliant classmates. Do any of them stand out? Are there any people you remember either from UBC or from your time in England?
I don't remember so well. I have one classmate from England who won the English Union Speaking Tour, and he was a brilliant fellow, and he's now a criminal barrister, and in the last few years he was made a QC, and he was a very interesting guy because he participated in debates, and debating was a very big university pastime and sport, as it were. Everybody showed up to debates to watch them, and having guest speakers coming in from London to speak was always a regular occurrence, and it was really important. And so my friend, he spoke at both Oxford and Cambridge in his year, and as I say, he won the English Union Speaking Tour, which meant he spent half a year traveling the United States with another fellow debating at American universities. Really, really, to this day, we're still really, really good friends. And I saw, it was over in England a couple summers ago, and saw him, and we shoot emails back and forth. And, yeah. So great guy. So,
from, I guess, more of the, or to really ask more about the UBC experience, do you remember any of your professors from the time at
Liz Edinger, a wonderful professor, did constitutional law and was just a tremendous personality on the faculty.
Yeah.
She was one of, at the time, a senior administrator of the faculty. And I don't know if she was dean or not at one time, but she was just an excellent professor and a great administrator. Really first class.
Yeah, she's still well reputed, or she's still at the school, and there's a lot of people who are instantly fans of
her. Oh, good. Yeah, did you take her?
No, I had, I guess the professor I had who's been around for a while was Professor Pavlich.
Oh, yes. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Fantastic. Yeah, and Tony Shepard.
Tony Shepard's, yeah, still around.
Is he still around?
Yeah.
He was a great professor. I think every year he won the Favorite Professor Award. And it was just a very great lecturer, really, really knew how to present his stuff, and just a great individual, too.
Interesting to hear. You are quite politically involved now, which we'll get to, but during your undergrad at UBC, is that when it started, or was it
a little bit?
Yeah.
A little bit at undergrad, but then a long hiatus of not being very actively or politically involved. I think in undergrad in 1982, I attended the Conservative Party, Progressive Conservative Party of Canada convention in Ottawa. So I was involved a little bit, but then went away to university, did other things, and then came back, was very involved with my law practice, and I have a passion for art, and I was a part-time student at the Ontario College of Art when I articled in Toronto. So I was busy doing that and all sorts of stuff.
That's something different that you won't hear from most lawyers, I think. And so now you're involved with the Conservative Party still.
Yes.
As director of your riding association in North Vancouver.
Yes.
And on the National Council, and you were elected president at the convention last year, 2016, in Vancouver.
Yes, and yes. That convention, I was the chair of that convention.
And so organized the whole thing, and
I was responsible for overseeing the organization. Yeah.
Do you believe it's important for lawyers to be leaders in the community?
Absolutely. We're very well trained, and we're given great opportunity to work with senior people in business organizations and community organizations, and we have the ability, and we should use it for good.
What other skills and qualities do you believe as a lawyer helps in these leadership roles?
Lawyers obviously have great analytical ability, so they can problem solve, and in leadership, often requires the ability to solve problems, analyze them, and be able to come to solutions and solve things. But also, particularly as you get trained as a lawyer, you learn how to conduct yourself and carry yourself, and you're valued as you get older as a lawyer for your judgment a lot. And those are things that really are key for leadership. So it's learning to be in difficult situations, to be civil and to carry yourself that way, and be able to be pragmatic, mm-hmm. to get results, solutions that people need. I guess that's generally what those legal skills have. Being able to understand how the law and how the human dynamic, after many years of practicing law, you see how people get into disputes and how they have problems getting out of them. But then you know a little bit about how you can solve those, even human dynamics, yeah. not just the legal technical problems, but the human dynamics. You learn that after a while.
That level of involvement also shows a deep passion for what you do. Where would you say that comes from in terms of volunteering with the Conservative Party?
Well, you know, there's a, I think it's an old saying, but it's true. Those who are given much, much is expected. And I believe that's important for everybody who's been given the privilege of the ability to practice law and to earn a good living, and that's a fairly privileged position you have, and you should use it for good, beyond just serving your clients when the opportunity arises.
Speaking to some of the other causes that you spend time with and for, I read that you are a hockey coach.
Yes.
Do you coach your family?
Yes. I love hockey. Pretty much what I did as a boy growing up in Edmonton. The rink was behind the school. It was outdoor rink. It was fantastic. I used to take my stick and skates there, play you know, after school. And it was a lot of fun. And wasn't able to play as much hockey when we moved here. Ice time was difficult, and it was not the same kind of carefree atmosphere about you know, playing hockey. But when my son was a little guy, he was playing soccer, and some of his friends were playing hockey as well, and he thought that would be kind of fun, and so he wanted to do it. And then next thing you know, he was on a friend of mine's team, and then I was helping out coaching. And then, well, you got to do this. You got to go through the program. It's Hockey Canada runs quite a good program, fairly rigorous, and making sure that we have people that know what they're doing with helping our kids learn something that's a lot of fun. And so I did it from initiation hockey all the way through to midget with my son's team.
Wow.
Yeah, we had a lot of fun. A friend of mine and I are coaching, and went to the banner final 3 times and won twice.
That's amazing.
Yeah, it was really great. It was really great. It was a lot of fun.
There's often sort of a reflection that it's hard to balance your life when you have the workload of a lawyer.
Yeah.
Is it things like hockey coaching that you find give you that perspective and that balance?
Yeah, I think that's right, Alex. I mean, it's, you know, it gets you out of the office and, out of a lot of the cares that the lawyers drag around with them every day, 7 days a week, and gets you into a mindset where you got a lot of, you know, young kids that are just excited to be out on the ice having fun, and to participate in that just takes you into a different place, which is very healthy, I think. And it's important to do those things. And, you know, if you're a parent, you only got so long with your children, and you know, as lawyers, we work very hard. We're very busy, but you should always leave your family as your priority.
I want to turn to speaking a little bit about your practice now. Have you been able to keep that interest in international relations from your first degree in your practice?
As a practical matter, not really. I mean, when I was at UBC Law, one of the things that I really enjoyed doing, which was an ability to undertake some seminar courses and do a lot of work in the area of free trade. And at that time, the Mulroney Conservative government was proposing a free trade agreement with the United States. And I was going through law school at the same time, so I wanted to know how this is all going to work. And one of the trade negotiators was here in Vancouver, and he gave us a course on trade law. And I thought it was great, and I wrote a paper on it, and it was very topical because at the time some law firms were issuing opinions about it. And so I had to write my paper what I thought about this new free trade agreement that Canada entered into, and we're about to head to the 1988 election. And so I was very interested in that. And after researching the paper and writing it, I became a convinced free trader. And I became convinced that this free trade agreement, despite the very virulent attacks by the Liberals and the NDP on the idea of this free trade agreement, I was convinced it was the right thing to do.
Yeah.
And so I always had an interest in that. To this day, I still have a very keen interest in trade matters, but I don't practice as a trade lawyer.
No.
And the closest I ever got to really doing a lot in that is I've given done some analysis and some advice on internal free trade, and I've written some articles and things like that on it, but nothing as a mainstay of my practice. My practice is completely different than trade law.
That's but you do, you are still involved with the Canadian Bar Association and their international law.
I've been involved for quite some time. It's been a long time. I was heavily involved back in about 2003 to 2003 or 4, and wrote the chapter on the international law section for the CLE annual review. And I enjoyed that because I got to review lots of great trade cases and keep my knowledge up and interest up. And since that time, I haven't been that involved. I was an editor of the Canadian International Lawyer Journal, and so I was very involved with doing that. But I've stepped away from that about 5 years ago, and just because so many other things have filled up my time, and particularly political stuff that's really occupied my time. And at the end of the day, you can't do it all. So,
What's it like running for president of the?
It was very interesting, and it's been a very rewarding experience.
Yeah.
What you come to realize is that political parties are vast volunteer organizations, and there's actually very few professional people that are actually paid every day to do the work of actually running the party. But the actual party functions with literally thousands of volunteers. What you realize is that without those volunteers, without those engagement of just everyday Canadians with a political party and the democratic process, we would not succeed as a democratic country. While I have opponents over in the Liberal Party and the NDP party, but the good news is that their involvement means we have a healthy democracy.
Yeah.
And the more you see of that, the more you realize. People are giving up their time. They're not asking to be paid for it. They're not asking for any reward. They just believe in their ideals, their values, and they want to have an ability to express them. And they do that through a political party.
Yeah, that's fascinating. It's like, I think you said it just like precisely. It's how like people volunteering their time helps the democratic process in the sense that it's not people who are just being paid to say the
no. They actually people. Believe this, and they devote hundreds and hundreds of hours. I mean, myself, I've done that, and I've done devoted a lot of time, and you do it for really the right reasons, and people have all sorts of points of view and all sorts of backgrounds they bring to it, but without them doing the work that they do. To get candidates nominated, to get candidates elected, we wouldn't have the vibrant democratic system we do, which is great.
That's amazing. That's so good. Speaking about how we've said you're not a trade lawyer, but in your practice now, and in your in your sort of profile on the Clark Wilson website, it says you're a results-oriented lawyer.
Yes.
You've said this before, you're pragmatic and you want to get solutions.
Yes.
How would you conceptualize a results-oriented lawyer?
I'm mostly in the commercial field of my the law. And so I deal with lots of business people and they have problems. And they seek my advice about how to solve those problems. Or they say, this is where I want to go, and how do I get there? Mm-hmm. And being a results-oriented lawyer means that you have to solve that problem for their business goal. Yeah. It's not about you and the law. It's about them and their problem and solving their problem and their issue. And so it's always thinking about, okay, this is a business problem. How do I put that in the context of the law to solve that problem?
Yeah.
And it's fun. It's great. It's you're always trying to figure out how to solve the puzzle, and it's very rewarding when you've kind of figured it out, and then you're able to execute that and get your client to where they want to be, and solve that business problem, whether it's navigating your way through some sort of regulatory problem or a contractual issue, or and in my world mostly it's about disputes, about very difficult and sometimes seemingly intractable problems. But if you can cut your way through that to get the result that they're seeking, very rewarding.
That's really interesting because it's not like
it's not about the legal solution.
It's not about the and it's not about being the smartest at knowing the law. It's about being the smartest at balancing all of these factors and what your client wants and using your knowledge of the law to really get to like where those two meet rather than just being.
And then plot a plan to get that done. And of course, being in the litigation and adversarial end of it, that's what you do. And you figure out a way to do that. And I enjoy that. I think that's it's very rewarding to see your clients achieve their business goals.
Yeah, that sounds both exciting and interesting in terms of doing that for your whole career. Speaking about being able to get solutions leads to a question of what career accomplishments would you say you're most proud of?
That's so far. That's a tough question. In terms of career accomplishments, obviously currently I'm very proud to be and very honored to be the president of the Conservative Party of Canada.
Yeah.
Funnily enough, if I look back at a couple of moments that are very gratifying for me, were not necessarily the big cases where we either got a good settlement or we got a victory in court. I would say, actually, funnily enough, a couple of small ones that when I first came back to Vancouver, I practiced a small firm initially with an old law school friend. And I got a call just before Christmas by a fellow that was new. I had helped people with international law problems. I had done some work in that area.
Yeah.
And he was from Bosnia, and he had come to Vancouver with his wife. And then when their visa ran out, or their holiday, I should say, he went back home, but she said she was going to stay. And then she didn't come back, and she stayed with her son here, claiming refugee status and that sort of thing. And he was very distraught. He wanted to see his son. It was just before Christmas. So he came to me and said, "Oh, you're an international lawyer." And I said, "Well, I know something about international law. But what you probably want is really a family law lawyer." And he said, "Well, it's really late. It was December 23rd or 24th. He said, "You got to help me to get to see my son." So I said, "Okay, I will. I'll just you're stuck. I'm going to try to help you if I can. And but I really think you need to kind of see a family lawyer. He said, no, just see what you can do to help me right now. So I said, okay, I will. So the long and the short of it is I wrote some letters and I contacted someone that it was, I found out who'd been acting for this woman and her refugee claim. And the long and the short of it is I managed to get this fellow a day at Christmas Day. He was able to spend with his son. And he came to visit me afterwards before he had to go back to Bosnia. And I never had an experience like it. The man was in tears. He gave me some flowers, gave me a box of chocolates and some brandy because he couldn't afford to pay me. And I said, well, I'm glad you saw your son. And it was a moment where I felt very proud to be a lawyer. Even though I'm not a family lawyer, and I probably never practiced that ever again, but I felt that I'd done something that was important to someone. And I've had another occasion where that happened, where I got a very good settlement for a family company, and it was a family-run business, and the business was in real trouble because of the litigation. And it was very serious, and the business could have been wiped out. And I managed to fend off the bad guys. And this mother's health had been really, really, really poor. And as we were getting deeper into the dispute, it got very, very serious. And when I solved it, her health improved and got better, and she recovered. And, you know, and the family was very grateful to me, and that was a kind of a moment that you don't normally get into when you're just dealing with business people and their problems. And while that's very rewarding, you'll never get that kind of feeling that you've really, really helped someone on a human level.
Yeah,
so those are a couple of small examples. No, I don't have a lot of those because I didn't practice in family law or any of these other areas, but I always kind of treasure those ones. I have a file where I keep all my wins and I keep all my losses, and I call it my humility file. But I put those that one case, it was a case, in there because it just reminds me of that the law can have a huge impact on people's lives on a very personal level. And we're very privileged to be able to help people and be able to assist them in those.
Yeah. It's the law is certainly that service profession, that working with people type profession.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's a couple questions that I want to still ask. Though there's one here in terms of thinking about your time working in BC and practicing law here. Are there any sort of memorable students that you've mentored or lawyers that you've had the chance to work with?
There's so many good lawyers that I've worked with over the years, and great personalities. I have to say this, you know, we're sometimes maligned in the public's mind as lawyers, but by and large, I think lawyers are a good bunch of people that are very talented intellectually and very capable, just with their great energy and drive, and they often become great public servants, and and they become often good businessmen, very successful.
It's amazing profession, really,
I'm just happy to be a part of it.
That's exciting. I guess then, is there any advice you'd share for law students who may be listening to this interview?
The law is a great challenge intellectually, as a study. As a practice, it's a tough taskmaster. It takes a lot of your time, a lot of your energy. But always, all those rigors and pressures. It's not an easy profession. Always just keep perspective on the value of your family and setting aside some time when the opportunities arise to do some good beyond just for yourself and your law firm.
And it's true, because like you staying involved outside of your law firm has helped you keep the balance.
Yeah, and you know what the bottom line is? It makes you a better lawyer.
Yeah.
It makes you not only a better person, but a better lawyer. You, because you said a moment ago, it's about dealing with people, helping people. And if you're, if you don't understand people, and you can't relate to them, it's hard to solve their problems. And it's hard to be able to, you know, serve them well and give them what they need.
Yeah.
And so if you spend all your time sitting in the office, I don't think that necessarily makes you a better lawyer.
I guess one last thing would be, is there anything else you'd like to share before we conclude today?
No, I've enjoyed this. I just hope this musings of my part are useful and helpful to your project, and just happy to help out.
Yeah, thanks for speaking with us today.
Thank you.